Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, presented in partnership with the Lafayette Library and Learning Center's Glenn Seaborg Learning Consortium. You can find the club online at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Joanna Perlstein, Deputy Managing Editor at Wired, and your moderator tonight. And now, it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished guest, J. Kenji Lopez-Ault. Kenji is the Managing Culinary Director at Serious Eats, a restaurant-trained chef, former editor at Cooks Illustrated, and, according to his own description, a nerd in the kitchen. Kenji got his inauspicious start in the restaurant world as a line cook in a Mongolian grill joint in Harvard Square.
Not even a line cook, actually. I started.
Oh, did I upgrade you?
I started as a prep cook, and then my first promotion was from prep cook to Knight of the Round Grill.
So I've promoted you already. He had planned to be a scientist and graduated from MIT, but found that he loved working in kitchens. So he took his science expertise and his love of food eventually to Cooks Illustrated and now to Serious Eats. In his James Beard Award-winning, nominated column, The Food Lab, Kenji unravels the science of home cooking, answering questions like, when is it okay to use dried herbs, and what's the best way to toast a bagel? His first book, The Food Lab, Better Home Cooking Through Science, is a New York Times bestseller. At nearly 1,000 pages, the book pays obsessive attention to details. 6 pages on onions, 8 pages on making stock, and 15 pages on potatoes. Tonight, we're here to discuss how a better understanding of the interactions between heat, energy, and molecules create truly great food. Please join me in welcoming J. Kenji Lopez-Ault to the Commonwealth Club. So, Kenji, I want to start tonight by talking about mistakes.
Okay.
We make them a lot in the kitchen, I think all of us, and I know that in your book you identify a lot of the things that we're doing wrong, from how much water we're using in our pasta to when we choose to sear our meat. So tell us, what are we doing wrong?
I mean, wrong is a strong word.
What can we be doing better, more science-y?
No, because I always say, you know, yeah, if there's one lesson to be learned, it's that if you're in the kitchen and there's somebody else in the kitchen, you always respect the person with the knife in their hand. so whatever they're doing it okay. You shouldn't criticize them. And of course, if you've been doing something one way your whole life and you're happy with the way it works out and it's working for you, then there's not really that much of a reason to change. But if on the other hand, like you're willing to experiment and willing to adapt a bit, then there are certain times when there are certain things that we take for granted or things that we learned from maybe our parents or our chefs or from TV chefs turn out, like, under scrutiny to not really be correct. I guess, like, a big example would be, there's tons of examples in the world of steak, for example. Uh-huh. People like talking about steak. I can talk about steak a bit. One of the big ones is that, searing seals and juices, which
right,
everyone hears.
Classic.
And at this point, I think most people know that it's not true. And it's really easy to prove for yourself. You can, if you just take a single steak, put it on a grill, get one side really nicely charred, then flip it over and just wait a few minutes, and you're going to see juices coming out of the side that was sealed. So the juices are not sealed in there. And if you want to take it further, you can actually take 2 steaks side by side, identical, sear one of them, and then finish it in the oven, like sort of the traditional method for cooking steak. Mm-hmm. Take the other one and do the opposite. Start it in the oven first, bring it up close to the final temperature you want to serve it at, and then sear it at the end. And you'll find that the one that you sear at the end actually retains more juices and ends up more tender and more evenly cooked than the one that you sear at the beginning. So it's actually a better way to sear steak. What's another one? Another one with steak. People say to if you want to get a good crust on your steak and you want it to remain nice and tender, you should take it out of the fridge like half an hour before you start cooking it, because it allows it to come to room temperature. There's a few different problems here. The first is that it doesn't actually allow it to come to room temperature. If you stick a thermometer in that steak, in half an hour, the core temperature of that steak is going to rise by 1, maybe 2 degrees. Even after like 4 hours, it only rises like 10, maybe 15 degrees. And that temperature, compared to what you're trying to raise it to, you know, you're trying to raise it, the surface of the steak, like the Maillard-Browning reactions, they don't take place until 340, 350 degrees. So the temperature between your fridge and room temperature is like a small fraction of the way to where you're actually raising that steak. Mm-hmm. It makes very little difference. And then the other important thing when you're talking about steak is that if you consider a pan and a heat source to be this energy system that's supplying this sort of constant output of energy, there's a fixed amount of energy coming out of the flame. Then there's a set amount of energy that's stored in the pan. So there's only so much energy you can store in the pan, and the thicker the pan, the more energy you can store in it. So you want to use a nice thick pan when you're searing a steak. But the thing is that when you're searing a steak, you can almost think of the energy as being a sort of a fixed bucket, and that's it. That's the energy you have to use, the energy that's stored in the pan. That energy is going into three different places in your steak. One of those places is to raise the temperature. The other one is to evaporate moisture. And then the third one is to do what we want to do, which is the browning. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, the Maillard reaction takes energy to take place, to kick it off. So there's those three different buckets. And if you look at the amount of energy that they're taking out of this pan, many people think that it's the temperature that takes the most energy, but it's not. It's actually by far the most energy goes into evaporating moisture. Mm-hmm. If you look at I don't know how many people remember their phase diagrams, but if you look at the phase diagram of water, it takes about 500 times more energy to evaporate a single gram of water than it does to raise that gram of water by 1 degree Celsius. Mm-hmm. Which means that even if your steak is starting out at freezing, and you're raising it all the way to 100 degrees, the boiling temperature of water in Celsius, it still takes five times more energy beyond that just to evaporate the moisture that you've just raised up by 100 degrees. So the starting temperature of the steak really has little to do with it. The most important thing when you're searing a steak is actually the dryness of the surface. So if you're searing a steak, you want to make sure you pat it nice and dry, or better yet, you take it out the day before, put it on a rack, and let it rest in the fridge uncovered overnight so that the surface gets dry. And it's a little bit counterintuitive, but when you start with a drier steak at the beginning, you actually end up with a moister steak at the end because it sears much faster, so you don't have as much sort of overcooked gray meat underneath that top surface. I don't know where we started. I somehow got into a tangent about steak.
We started with mistakes, so dry your steak before cooking it, maybe cook it in the oven first before searing it.
These are all things you
and
can do,
yes. Don't take it out of the refrigerator thinking that you're going to raise the temperature. And
I mean, yeah, you can, but
favors.
You're not really doing yourself any favors. Yeah.
Let's talk for a minute about salt.
Okay.
Salt is so important in so much cooking, and one of the things. So I want to talk about two things. It's salting meat. Mm-hmm. Let's talk while we're on the topic of steak. So what are we supposed to be doing with salting our meat? You should start before. You should not. It's drawing the moisture out, of course, when you put salt on there.
Right. So salt does a couple things. All right. So first of all, it's one of the most important ingredients in cooking. You use it in almost every dish, sweet or savory. So you know, part of it is flavor. It enhances flavors. It makes your tongue and your it enhances the way you perceive other flavors. But it also has a very powerful chemical and physical role in cooking with meat. So if we're talking about steak, some people will tell you not to salt the steak until after you're done cooking. Some people will tell you to salt it right before. Some people will tell you to salt it like way before. I did a bunch of experiments on this, salting steaks and cooking them at various time intervals, like everywhere from 0 minutes to like 4 days after salting them. What you find is that when you initially season a steak, that salt initially is going to draw out some of the moisture from the steak. Osmosis, if you remember your fifth grade biology, chemistry, whatever it is, it draws out some of the liquid from the steak. And so you can actually see it. Just salt a steak and let it sit out at room temperature for about 5 minutes, and you're going to see moisture start to beat up on the surface. Mm-hmm. So if you try to sear your steak during like that window between, say, like 3 minutes after salting and about 45 minutes after salting, the surface of that steak has a lot of moisture on it, and that's going to very rapidly make the pan lose energy because, again, mm-hmm. it takes a lot of energy to evaporate moisture. It's going to rob energy from the pan. Your steak's going to sit there steaming instead of searing. So you don't want to salt. You don't want to cook your steak within that 3 minute to 45 minute window. You can salt it immediately. You can cook it immediately after salting. But if you want to do it even better, if you wait long enough, what happens is that liquid comes out of the steak, then the salt dissolves in that liquid, and it forms like a really concentrated brine on the surface. Mm-hmm. And when salt in a brine in liquid form interacts with meat proteins, it dissolves some of them, mainly a protein called myosin. It dissolves something. And if you look at a steak, the structure of a steak, it looks kind of like a bunch of bundled up tubes, like telephone wires all bundled up, or toothpaste tubes, something like as the steak cooks, and this is the same whether you're talking about a steak or a pork chop or a turkey breast, anything. As it cooks, those tubes kind of squeeze out, and moisture comes out of the surface, and just like toothpaste, once that once you squeeze that stuff out, it's really hard to get it back in. So what you want to do is minimize the amount of squeezing that goes on. So salt will dissolve some of the muscle proteins, which makes it so that as you cook the steak, it squeezes a little bit less firmly. So it'll help the steak retain moisture. And moreover, once the salt dissolves those proteins, the liquid that was pulled out by the salt will then get reabsorbed into the steak. So if you watch a steak, and I know you're all going to do this, salt a steak and just sit there staring at it for like an hour, you'll see moisture come out and then eventually get sucked back in. And so you want to cook your steak during the dry spells, either at the beginning or after the 45-minute period. Preferably after the 45-minute period, or even after a couple days in the fridge. Like as I said, like the outside will dry out, the salt will work its way into the meat, so it'll be seasoned a little bit more evenly, and it'll lose less moisture when you cook it.
So you mentioned brining. And thing that I think has gotten really popular in recent years. And mm-hmm. I was surprised to read in your book that you are not a fan of, for example, like, it doesn't seem like you're much into the brined chicken.
I'm not.
Chicken, or the brined turkey. And I thought brining is the thing that everybody's doing now.
Yeah.
What is up with brining?
So brining, I mean, so it's basically the same process I just talked about.
But the
actual process you do in the kitchen is you take a turkey or a chicken, usually poultry, sometimes people do it with pork chops, and you dunk it in salt water and you let it sit there for, half an hour or up to a couple days. And the same thing happens. The muscle proteins will slowly break down. It'll absorb some of that brine into it. And then when you cook it, it won't squeeze out as much. The problem with brining, though, is that the extra liquid that you're adding to that chicken or that turkey is water. And so you end up with turkey that is moist, but it's watery, and it waters down the flavor. And for me, it doesn't. I don't want that. I mean, I'd rather have a flavorful and moist turkey. So what I do instead is dry brining, which is very similar to what I talked about with the steak again. You season the bird very heavily with salt. If you want to get messy, it works better if you put the salt in between the skin and the meat. And then you let it sit, and that salt will slowly work its way into the meat. You're not introducing any extra liquid, but you are preventing the bird from squeezing too tightly as it then cooks down the line. The other way to make sure that your poultry stays juicy is to use a thermometer, and don't overcook it, because people overcook poultry all the time, because it's, you know, a lot of people think better safe than sorry, which is fair, but if you use a thermometer, you can be safe and not sorry, I guess.
Well, so the USDA says that you should cook your poultry to 165 degrees.
I'm doing this panel tomorrow with the Deputy Secretary of the USDA tomorrow, and I've spent a lot of time talking about how you shouldn't listen to what the USDA says. But anyhow, the USDA says cook your poultry to 165 degrees. They're crazy.
Well, but you have a chart in the book that kind of explains the change in number of bacteria.
So the 165 degree number is the minimum temperature you wanted to get it to if you wanted to be instantly safe to eat. So what the USDA actually has published figures on this, destroying bacteria, which is the goal of cooking and pasteurization, killing the bacteria is a function of both temperature and time. So at 165 degrees, you get a 7-log reduction in bacteria. That means that only one out of every 10 million bacteria will survive within 2 seconds. At 150 degrees, it takes something like 4 or 5 minutes. At 145 degrees, it takes like 12 to 18 minutes, something like that. You can pasteurize as low as 130 degrees, and I think it takes a couple hours. I don't know off the top of my head, but it's in the book. It takes something like a couple hours at 130 degrees. I don't know anybody who enjoys the texture of 130 degree chicken, but 150 degree chicken or 150 degree turkey is really great. And what you have to realize is that the entire time between that the chicken is rising from 130 to 150 degrees, bacteria are actively being destroyed at that point. So by the time you get to 150 degrees, you pull it out of the oven and you let it rest. It sits there for 5 to 10 minutes, and at that point, you've pasteurized it the same as if you had raised it to all the way up to 165 degrees and let it sit and ate it immediately. So as long as you're safe, you know, as long as you're careful about taking your temperatures and making sure that you're safe with your timing, it can be every bit as safe to cook poultry to a slightly lower temperature, and it comes out way, way, way juicier.
And it does sometimes continue to cook once you take it out of the oven. So if you took it out at 160, you might see some temperature rise even after that. Is that the case?
That is the case. And again, it depends on a number of factors. So it depends on the size. So like a turkey or like a prime rib is going to raise in temperature a lot more as it comes out. Because what's happening is that if you look at like a if you have like your predator glasses on and you're looking at the cross section of meat and you see like the infrared, you're going to see like the outside bands are like bright red and the middle is blue. And it's because, you know, things cook from the outside in. So as you let it rest, heat from the outside, some of it dissipates back out into the kitchen. Mm-hmm. Some of it works its way into the meat. So the center is going to raise in temperature. But of course, that that change in temperature and the gradient is a function of how hot your oven is. So if you're cooking, if you're roasting a prime rib at like 500 degrees, there's going to be a much bigger temperature gradient built into it than if you're roasting it at, well, if you're roasting it at like 130 degrees, which is the temperature that you're medium rare, the temperature you you serve it, there's going to be zero gradient.
Right.
And that's sort of the thought process behind sous vide cooking, mm-hmm. Or like a lot of these sort of modern precise temperature cooking apparatus.
Apparati.
Yeah.
That sounds good. So I was interested to see in your cookbook the appearance of some ingredients that we don't often see in, for example, I don't usually think of, I think, anchovies in my meatloaf.
Oh, okay.
and, or I don't think of Marmite in my vegetarian stew, or no, vegetarian chili. So you've got Marmite is really pretty popular in anchovies. I know a lot of people and I know a lot of people who don't like anchovies are kind of like wrinkling their noses right now, saying, "What are you talking about?" And then of course soy sauce. But you describe these things as your umami bombs. So, what is that
umami
stuff doing in our food?
Marmite, soy sauce, anchovies, and fish sauce sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
They're umami bombs. So they're ingredients that are really really rich in glutamic acid and inosinic acid, which are two amino acids that trigger our sense of savoriness. So it's the same way that sucrose or fructose or glucose will trigger our sense of sweetness, and the same way that sodium chloride, table salt, will trigger our sense of saltiness, glutamic acid triggers our sense of savoriness. So by adding some of it to dishes and I do this whenever I want a sort of meaty flavor. So if I'm any kind of soup or stew or braise, by adding a little bit of those ingredients to it, you can really enhance the meatiness of a dish without actually making the eater even aware that there's something off in there. You know, it's not like the beef stew in the book tastes like fish sauce or anchovies.
I'm sure it does not.
But it's there and it enhances the meatiness.
Uh-huh. We have questions for the audience.
Sure.
Tonight, and we were just talking about salt, so let me read this question.
Okay.
How many different kinds of salt do you recommend to have in your kitchen, and which is the best for eggs?
Okay, how many different kinds of salt? I typically have more salts than I need in the kitchen. I would say at a minimum, you'd want two, maybe three if you like popcorn.
Mm-hmm.
So kosher salt is what I use for like 99% of my cooking because it's easy to pick up with your fingers. So kosher salt is not, it's really, the only difference between kosher salt and regular table salt is the shape of the grain. And actually that's essentially only the difference between any salt. You see these fancy sea salts that have minerals or they're black or they're pink. And those colors, they're mainly just visual appeal. Once you dissolve them in water or they hit your food, like you don't really taste much of a difference in the salt. But texture does make a difference. So table salt is made for putting in shakers, and it flows easily, and it comes out of tiny holes, and you can use it at the table. Kosher salt, on the other hand, it has much sort of coarser grains, and they're made for, and it's much easier to sort of pick them up and sprinkle them evenly over your food, which is what you really want to do. So for me, I always salt with my fingers. So I keep kosher salt. And then I also will keep some kind of like large flaked finishing salt. And again, the salt that I use to finish things with is not, it's not that it has a different flavor, but it has a different texture and it adds like those little crunchy salt crystals. So I like to use either Maldon sea salt, which is a salt from England, or Fleur de Sel, which is a kind of moist, kind of jagged crystalled salt from France.
Mm-hmm.
And then let's see. And then, well, you don't even need the third salt because you can just take kosher salt and grind it up in the food processor, or grind it up in the spice grinder, and that turns into your popcorn salt. I eat a lot of popcorn. So.
Popcorn salt, the specific popcorn salt.
Well, you need the super fine grains because it doesn't stick otherwise. It just ends up piling up at
right.
the bottom of the bowl.
Good point. And for kosher salt, you use diamond?
I use diamond crystal. I mean, Morton's is fine too. The one thing you have to be aware of when you're using kosher salt is that in recipes that are written for table salt, kosher salt is less dense because table salt is little cubes and they can pack together really tightly. Kosher salt is irregular flakes, so they don't pack together quite as tightly. So you have to make sure you convert. So if you're baking, for instance, and a recipe calls for a teaspoon of table salt, off the top of my head, I think it's like you need like 1.6 teaspoons of diamond crystal and like 2 teaspoons of Morton's kosher salt because
Morton's
it's
has
less
bigger
dense.
Crystals.
Yeah, much bigger crystals, mm-hmm. exactly.
great. So that's your eggs question.
Oh, and the best salt for eggs. I use kosher salt. And here's a trick for your eggs, by the way. If you're gonna scramble your eggs or make an omelet, you always want to salt. And people, many chefs will say the opposite of this, but you can try it out for yourself at home, and it's very easy to prove those chefs wrong again. Salt your eggs before you cook them, and preferably actually a little while before, like up to like 15 minutes before. and what it does is actually a very similar thing to what it does in the turkey or the steak. It's going to denature some of those egg proteins so that when they subsequently form that like kind of protein net, when you cook them, scramble them, or turn them into an omelet, the proteins form this kind of like protein net that holds liquid in. By salting them beforehand, the net doesn't squeeze quite as tightly, so it makes the eggs a little bit more tender, and it also helps them retain more moisture. So if you've ever been to like a breakfast buffet and you like see the scrambled eggs and there's like a pool of water at the bottom, it's called like it's syneresis. It's like when like a semi-solid weeps out water. It's probably because they didn't salt them before they cooked, or they just overcooked them. But if you salt your eggs before you scramble them, you minimize the amount of moisture that weeps out.
Speaking of eggs, an audience member wants to know how they can boil an egg so that it's easy to peel.
Oh, okay.
you should see the page in the book with all of the different eggs and the way that he cooked them.
Okay, so this is a question that I've had for years. Actually like 2 years ago was when I finally decided, okay, like I'm going to figure this out. I got a bunch of people to blind peel eggs. Not literally blindfolded, but I gave them like hundreds of eggs that were boiled in different ways. I didn't tell them how the eggs were cooked, and I just had them peel them, and then I had them both tell me how easy they thought the eggs were to peel, and then I also examined all the eggs to see like how many holes and pits and divots they had in them. And the one thing that makes by far the most difference, and it's like a night and day difference, is the temperature of the water that you start the eggs in. So if you put your eggs in cold water and bring the temperature up slowly, the egg whites will fuse to the shell. If you start them in already boiling water, or if you start them in a steamer with really hot steam in it, they peel much more easily. So for peeling eggs, it's the temperature, starting temperature of the water is like by far the most important thing. And then the other trick with boiling eggs is if you want to get, you know, eggs have that little airspace in the fat end. As the egg gets older, that airspace gets bigger and bigger. If you want to eliminate that airspace, as soon as you finish boiling the eggs, shock them in ice water. Because what happens, the reason that divot forms is because as they're boiling, air pressure builds up, that bubble starts to expand, and it forms that divot. When you shock them in ice water, it'll very rapidly cause that bubble to shrink again, and it'll kind of pull the egg while it's still warm and soft, and it'll have it fill out the shell more nicely. So if you want perfect deviled eggs, start your eggs in boiling water, and then shock them in ice water right after cooking them.
And how many minutes?
It depends how hard you like them. So the boiled egg recipe in the book is like probably the world's most complicated boiling egg recipe. But you add the eggs to boiling water for about 30 seconds, and then you leave them there for about 30 seconds, and then you add a little bit of ice because if you boil them at full boil, full tilt the whole time, they end up a little bit rubbery. You can do it, and it's not the end of the world. But they end up a little bit rubbery. So I add a little bit of ice, and I cook them at like sort of a very bare simmer the rest of the way. And it's like 11 to 12 minutes for hard-boiled. Same thing if you're going to steam them. It's about the same timing.
So speaking of boiling things in water, I was surprised to learn that after many decades of preparing pasta, I have been doing it all wrong. And so probably all of us together. So you have an unusual idea of, well, and I will just say it. So it is a stereotype that the way that you cook pasta is you have, I don't know, a couple of quarts of water for every pound of pasta.
Yeah, I was told a gallon per pound, yeah.
Okay. Anyway, so that's a lot of water, and that you should put oil in the water to prevent the pasta from sticking.
Right.
What's wrong with that?
Well, so the oil thing, first of all, like oil. I mean, the oil floats on the surface. It's not going to prevent the pasta floating. It would be like if we poured oil on the roof here, and then all of a sudden we all got lubed up. it doesn't prevent pasta from sticking. It will prevent bubbles from overflowing, maybe. That's about the extent of what oil will do. Sticking a spoon in there will also do that because it gives a place for the bubbles to break. The other big thing is that you don't need a gallon of water per pound of pasta. You can actually do it with just enough water to cover the pasta. And so what I was always told, the reason that you do this is because if you have a large volume of water and a small volume of water and you add pasta to them, that the large volume of water is going to have a lower drop in temperature and therefore it's going to come back to a boil faster, and so your pasta is going to be vigorously boiling for longer. This is actually not true. If you're living in like a in a physics problem where there's no energy escaping from your pots, no matter what the size of the pot of water you have, if you add the same amount of pasta to it, the amount of energy you need to get it to return to a boil is the amount of energy it takes to raise the temperature of that fixed amount of pasta from room temperature to boiling temperature. So no matter the size of the pot of pasta, it's going to return to a boil at the exact same time. The thing, though, is that we don't live in a physics problem. We live in a real world, and in the real world, a big pot is actually losing more energy to the kitchen than a small pot is. So if you try this side by side, one quart of water in a small pot, a gallon of water in a big pot, add the same amount of pasta to both of them at the same time, you'll find that the small pot actually returns to a boil faster than the big pot does. So it's the opposite of what people thought. The only other reason why you might want to boil in a big pot of water is that it prevents the pasta from sticking because it doesn't run into itself as much. In a small pot, the thing that causes pasta to stick to itself is the raw starches. And in a small pot of water, as long as you're stirring for like the first minute or so, and this happens in a big pot too, it settles to the bottom, you have to stir for the first minute. As soon as like those exterior starches set, it's not going to stick to itself anymore anyway. So you can get away with boiling pasta in just as much water as it takes to cover it. And you can't tell taste it side by side, you can't tell the difference in the cooked pasta. There's actually several advantages to cooking in less water. So there's the obvious advantages that you're using less water, which is important here. You use less energy. It comes to a boil faster. And then finally, the big culinary advantage is that you end up with a more concentrated pasta water. So I used to work in an Italian restaurant in Boston, and I was on the pasta station there. So we had this like big like 25-gallon pot of boiling water, and you had like a bunch of baskets that you drop pasta into it. So at the beginning of the night, the water was very, very clear and clean. So when you go to finish your pasta, you take your pan of sauce, you take your pasta, you dump the pasta into it, and then you add a little bit of the pasta water to it. And the idea is that the pasta water adds some starch to that liquid, which then in turn helps the sauce bind to the pasta so that it coats it more nicely. At the beginning of the night, you're basically adding like just plain water to it, so it didn't work very well. So over the course of the night, the water would get starchier and starchier, and this is a tip: if you go to Italian restaurants, you should make your reservation later in the night because the pasta comes out better. This. It's true. The pasta comes out better later in the night at an Italian restaurant.
Because there's more starch in the water.
Because there's more starch in the water. So when you cook with a smaller pot of water, you end up with more. It's like you're cooking in that late night pasta water, and the pasta water comes out starchier. It binds your sauce better. So like in every way you can think, I can think of, it's better. Other than like not offending an Italian, it's better to cook in a small pot of water.
Kind of a surprising thing. We have a question from an audience member who asks, what are the most important cooking techniques for people new to the kitchen who can barely make toast?
Learn how to make toast. knife skills are really important. Like getting yourself a good knife and learning how to cut things properly, I think is probably mm-hmm. the most important, because unless you're cutting your things evenly, you're not going to be able, if you don't start with evenly cut ingredients, you can't cook evenly. And and I've seen this a lot. You know, when I was like in maybe just out of college, I had a lot of friends who were seriously getting into food then, and they would like buy the French Laundry cookbook and they would try to cook these like French Laundry meals, but they wouldn't know how to hold a knife properly, and so the food doesn't come out particularly great because things don't cook properly when they're not cut properly. So I'd say, knife skills is the most important thing to learn, followed by just training your tongue to know when things have the right level of salt. Seasoning properly is another big mistake I see people make. Like
under-seasoning?
Over? It goes both directions, mm-hmm. Yeah. People under or over-season, because I think a lot of people don't taste as they're cooking. Mm-hmm. Just get in the habit of tasting all the time and training yourself to like think about like, all right, like is the salt level correct here? Is the acidity correct? And sort of like those basic flavors like savory, salty, acidic, like could a little bit of heat make this better? A little bit of sweetness. The basic flavors that you sense on your tongue, balancing those I think is a really important skill to have.
Okay. Another audience member wants to know what has been the most surprising thing that you've learned during your experiments about cooking.
The most surprising thing I learned. The pasta one. That wasn't something that I discovered. So that was, Harold McGee wrote about that in the New York Times mm-hmm. in like 2007. But when I read that, I remember being like, "Whoa." I don't know. Yeah, that's a difficult question. I don't know. I mean, the boiled eggs, I don't know.
All right.
It's hard. It's hard.
Let's see, what else do I want to ask you? Well, let's see, let me find another audience member question. Talked about eggs. Meat thermometer. So you mentioned meat thermometer is very important. Do you have a particular brand that you would recommend or a feature that people should be looking for?
Yeah, I mean, so I use a ThermoPen. They're like the Cadillac of meat thermometers. You know, they're pricey, but they're faster and they're accurate, and they have like a lot of like nice features that make them easy to use. So I do recommend the ThermoPen. It's now the original one is like $79, and there's a new one that's like $90-something. The new one's really cool because it has an accelerometer so that you can put it down and it'll turn itself off, but then like when you need it, you just pick it up and it's on again, which I think is really cool.
That is definitely for somebody who cooks a lot.
But ThermoPen's great. It's accurate to like within 0.1 degrees. It takes the temperature like within 2 to 3 seconds. It's also expensive. They have a cheaper version called the ThermoPop, which is a similar. It's a different type of sensor. So it's not a thermocouple. It's like a bimetal sensor, which is a slightly slower sensor. So it takes like 5 to 7 seconds to sense. But it's also like a quarter of the price. But really any kind of meat thermometer is, you know, as long as it's accurate, I think that's the most important thing. Beyond that, it's just sort of frills and convenience. A thermometer is like one of the most important tools. If you cook meat at all, that is. If you're vegetarian, you can probably get away with no thermometer. But if you ever cook meat, like a thermometer is by far, like after the knife, the most important tool in the kitchen. Mm-hmm. Because it's the only way to really guarantee that you're cooking things correctly, and that when you cut into it, it's not going to be overdone or underdone. You'll see like TV chefs going back to steaks. You see TV chefs tell you like, poke the steak, and if it feels like your cheek, that's medium rare, and if it feels like your chin, that's medium, and if it feels like your forehead, that's well done. And it's like, all right, so everybody like poke their cheek right now, right? Okay, so now that's a medium rare steak. All right, now everybody like poke the cheek to the person on your right. And I guarantee you, their cheek feels different from yours. So, how do you know if you have a medium rare cheek or a well done forehead? Like, you don't know. And so, that advice always baffles me. It's good advice. Like, if you work in a restaurant where you're cooking the exact same steak 100 times a night, and you always have the exact same cheek, and then you can compare it, and then maybe you get a feel for it. But for like a home cook who cooks a steak maybe at most once or twice a month, probably only a couple times a year, like you're never going to develop that kind of feel for just by poking. Just get a thermometer and you never have to worry about it again. You know, like 100, 125, 130 degrees is medium rare, and that's it. Like that's all you need to know.
Makes it a lot easier.
You can poke yourself if you want, but.
So you mentioned turkey a little bit, and Thanksgiving is coming up. So I imagine some of us are wondering, what are you going to make? What would you recommend? You're going to make turkey. What are you going to do with your turkey?
I'm going to spatchcock it.
Explain what spatchcocking is.
So you basically just like hack out the back. You can get the butcher to do it for you, and then you spread it out, and it looks really pornographic. And then you just press it down and bake it and roast it. The reason you do it. Turkey has this problem, and all poultry has it. There's a problem with poultry. The problem is that poultry is made of two different kinds of meat. There's fast twitch muscle, which is the breast meat, and that's the muscle that rarely gets used while the chicken or the turkey is alive. But it's there just in case it needs to like flee a predator or fly up in a tree and roost or whatever it needs to do. Then there's the slow twitch muscle, which is the legs and the thighs and the wingtips, things like that. And those are the muscles that they use all the time, every day. Two very different structures. One of them is dark. One of them is light. Slow twitch muscle also has a lot more connective tissue because it's constantly being used to move limbs around. A lot more connective tissue. So. Lean, fast twitch muscle will dry out if you cook it beyond 150 degrees or so, 155 degrees. On the other hand, slow twitch muscle, that connective tissue doesn't really begin to soften and tenderize until you're at like 165 or 170 or even higher. So the problem is you have two different temperature zones on the same animal and you have to cook them at the same time. So how do you deal with that? The traditional way to cook a turkey is you take a roasting pan and you stick a rack in it and you put the turkey in it, and that's like the worst way you can cook a turkey because next time you put a turkey in a roasting pan, look at it and you'll see that the metal comes up like this and it's protecting those thighs and those legs from the heat of the oven. Meanwhile, the breast is fully exposed, so you're directing heat at like the part that you want to cook the slowest, and meanwhile you're protecting this. So by the time the legs are at like 165, 175 degrees, your turkey breast is like completely overcooked, and that's why like I grew up eating really dry turkey breast. So some people will flip the turkey over, which works better, but then you end up with no skin, no crispy skin. And then some people will actually like flip the turkey halfway through baking, and that's like, I think, crazy. Much easier way to do it is you just, all right, so there's a couple easy ways to do it. One, if you really want to insist on having that like perfect Norman Rockwell instead of Norman Rockwell looking turkey on your table, you can take a baking stone, like a pizza stone or a baking steel, if you have one of those, preheat it in a really hot oven, like as hot as your oven will go, preheat it for like half an hour or so, drop the temperature down to the temperature you're going to roast your turkey, and then place the roasting rack on top of that, and the heat from the stored energy from the stone will come in and help the legs cook a lot faster. That's a very quick, easy way to do it. If you want better results, though, and you don't mind your turkey coming out of the oven looking like a porn star, you cut its back out, spread it open, press down on its back so that on its breast so that it's flat, and then lay it on a sheet tray. So like I use like a jelly roll pan, like a rimmed baking sheet with a rack in it. So first of all, you're gonna save yourself like $150 because you don't need that like expensive roasting pan. You just need like a $15 rimmed baking sheet. But then when you look at the turkey like that, at that point, with the legs fully exposed like that, the legs are now the thinnest part and the least protected part of the turkey. Meanwhile, the breast is much thicker. So you'll find that the legs, you can put it into like a very hot oven, like 400, 450 degrees. And you'll find that by the time the turkey or chicken breast is at 150 degrees, the legs are at like 175. Everything cooks at the exact same time. You have much more exposed surface area, so you get crispy skin all over it. It cooks a lot faster. It cooks in like less than half the time. You can cook like a 10 to 12 pound turkey in like an hour or so.
Everybody's
and what else is better about it? Oh, you get a backbone to work with, so you can use your backbone to make stock out of it. It's just, I think it's just a better way to roast a turkey, as long as you don't need that pretty turkey at the end.
And you're salting it first, and for how long?
I'm going to salt it. I'm going to do salt between the skin and the skin.
So you lift up the skin and stick it under there.
Get in there. Yeah. Salt it. I'll probably do like 2 days, maybe 3 days. It depends when I have it. And then roast it. Yeah.
And are you an heirloom? You know the turkey's name.
When I'm buying meat, it's going to be like. And I rarely like cook meat for myself at home. So for the holidays, yeah. When we're buying meat, it's like we buy the most well-treated animals we can find, because animals are typically not treated very well.
And what are some of the side dishes that you'll be doing?
Stuffing.
Not stuffed in the bird, obviously.
No. Sometimes if I'm spatchcocking it, I'll put like a little handful of stuffing underneath that breast cavity. Then everybody gets a little bit of the bird stuffing, you know, which is nice. But no, I do it in a pan on the side. Brussels sprouts are always essential. We'll probably do mashed potatoes and roast sweet potatoes. We do. And then what else do we do? Gravy, salad, pies.
Uh-huh. Is there Marmite or anchovies in your gravy, or both?
I can't remember what's in the gravy in the book. There's probably both. I don't know. The gravy we do at home, so I grew up, my mother's Japanese, so the gravy we made at home, there's soy sauce in it, but there's actually like a lot of soy sauce. Like it tastes like a soy sauce gravy. Mm-hmm. So we do that. So there'll be soy sauce in our gravy.
Yeah. Nice. Let me see what else. Somebody wants to know if you miss the hustle and bustle of a restaurant kitchen.
I do, yeah. I mean, I worked in restaurant kitchens for about seven, eight years, something like that. I definitely miss like the adrenaline and like the teamwork and all that. That all of that was great. I don't miss never seeing my family and not having friends and not sleep. Like I don't miss any of that part. But I do miss the hustle and bustle. But I get a taste for it. So right now, during this whole book tour thing, I'm doing a series of these pop-up restaurants all around the country, actually. So I've done two fried chicken pop-ups in New York. I did one in L.A. a couple days ago. I'm going to be doing one in San Francisco at some point soon. It's not announced yet, but at some point soon. But I do get a chance to like get into kitchens and work with people. And so that's always really fun. But yes, I do miss kitchens to a degree. Yeah.
Nice. Let me see. This is a very funny San Francisco Bay Area question.
Okay.
Are you ready? What's the best burrito in San Francisco? And also, they would like to know, what is your preferred burrito meat?
Okay. I'm going to offend a lot of people here, probably. I'm not a burrito eater. I feel like burritos are just one of those things that I don't get. I would much rather, if I feel like someone took my plate and rolled it all together, and I'd rather just have all the things separate. That's how I feel, at least. I'd rather have a taco. My favorite tacos, I can tell you where those are.
Yes, please.
My favorite tacos are from the Pollo Hero, Gallo Hero? Gallo Hero, maybe it's called? It's a truck on 23rd and Treat. And it's a truck that does, their carnitas are good, but they do this chicken thigh taco, which is weird. Like chicken doesn't sound like a great ingredient for a taco, but they're really, really good. I think my favorite brick and mortar is probably Vallarta, which is on Mission and 24th and Bryant, maybe something like that.
That's about right.
Yeah. If I was going to get a burrito though, and it had to be meat, it would probably be carnitas.
I want to ask you another question about meat, which is, I think a lot of people today go to the butcher counter in their local market and are a little bit mystified by, you know, chuck roast and hanger steak and tri-tip and the variety of cuts that are out there. And I'm wondering if you can identify some of the cuts that people are not paying attention to and are maybe a little bit of the undersung heroes of the meat counter.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say there's anything people aren't paying attention to because people pay attention to everything now. But your typical big steaks are the ones that come off the back of the cow, and those are like your strip loin and your ribeye and your tenderloin, and those ones tend to be really pricey because again, like this is fast twitch muscle. It's muscle that the cow very rarely uses, so it tends to be much more tender. But there are other cuts of steak that come, as long as the butcher knows what they're doing, they come from places that get more of a workout and then therefore get more flavor in them. And as long as the butcher cuts them correctly, they can be quite tender. So, hanger steak is one that everybody knows. I love hanger steak. It comes from the diaphragm. Flank steak used to be relatively inexpensive. Now it's like one of the most expensive things you can get. And I don't even think flank steak is that great. Skirt steak, I think, is my favorite steak for the grill, period. Super high heat skirt steak. One steak that people don't think of as a steak, short rib, boneless short rib. If you get like a nice meaty chunk of short rib, there's a lot of fat in there, and you can grill it medium rare just like a steak. And the only trick with short rib is that you want to make sure that you don't just serve it whole. You want to always slice it with a really sharp chef's knife before serving and slice it as thin as you can. Short rib steaks sliced super thin come out really tender, and they're like the richest, really, really amazing steaks. If you go to like an Argentinian steakhouse or a Korean barbecue place, they use short ribs as steaks. It's just a thing that Americans don't seem to do, but they're really good as steaks.
Now sometimes you see boneless short ribs marketed as Korean style.
Oh yeah?
I've seen that in the market now, and I think that's probably why. Another audience member wants to know, what are your favorite dishes to cook and to eat?
My favorite dishes to cook. I like anything involving eggs, typically, because eggs are one of those ingredients that it's like they're so simple and you cook them all the time, but there's just like a million different things you can do with them, and they're so sensitive to technique. I'm a guy that kind of focuses more on technique than combining odd flavors. For me, it's really exciting to be able to like coax different textures out of just like an egg. So I like cooking eggs. I love cooking. It's not even in the book, but I love cooking Sichuan food because. Sichuan and Thai food. Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, the things in the book are all things that are sort of really familiar to an American audience. So they're all things that I really like, but there are other things that I also really like that aren't in the book. Mapo tofu is my favorite food of all time, and I cook that quite a bit. So if I'm having like a dinner party for friends, I often will cook Chinese or Thai, so a lot of like stir-fried things, because I find it just so simple, especially like when you're out here and there's like such great produce. Stir fries are like a great way to get flavor out of produce because it's just such a quick cooking method that sort of maintains a lot of the natural flavor of the vegetables. Vegetables and eggs I like. Yeah.
So we talked a little bit about some of the meats that people aren't using, and we talked about the umami delivery mechanisms, I guess I'll say. I'm just wondering if there are other ingredients that are available, especially here in the Bay Area or in California, that don't get as much attention as they should be, and you say, I know that you moved from New York recently. Are there things that you can get here, and you think, oh my God, why is nobody using nettles or whatever it is?
No, because I think people here are pretty good about using things, particularly when it comes to produce. I mean, that's, I think, one of the things that California has better than pretty much anywhere else in the world is produce, and people are really good about it. No, I think people, I haven't found any ingredients that I'm like, I can't believe you guys have this and aren't doing anything with it. I think people are pretty creative and pretty resourceful here and tend to do good. Yeah.
Uh-huh. An audience member wants to know about frying pans. Mm-hmm. What's the best way to care for them?
It depends what kind of frying pan you're using. So I tend to use either cast iron or triple clad stainless steel aluminum core. Sometimes I'll use I have a couple nonstick pans that I use for certain things occasionally. Cast iron is my favorite material because it's cheap, it's heavy, it's like virtually indestructible, which is surprising because if you read online about how people tell you to care for your cast iron pan, it's like they're treating a baby, and it's not. It's like, yeah, this is a thing that's been around since your grandmother gave you this pan. It's been around for 100 years. Like, there's not much you can do that's going to break it or mess it up. There are a couple things you could do. Like, the only way to totally mess up a cast iron pan is to heat it as hot as you can get and then dump it in a bucket of ice water. That'll break it, probably. You can do that. It'll mess it up. You can, like, maybe... cook really acidic ingredients in it for a week and then like let it sit in your attic for 50 years and maybe it'll corrode and pit and then you can't use it anymore. But other than that, like, there's not much you can do that's going to mess up a cast iron pan. The thing about cast iron pan seasoning, people tell you like, oh, don't use any soap. Or some people say like, oh, don't even use any water. Just like wipe it out with paper towels. Like, you can use soap in a cast iron pan because, the layer of seasoning, which is what happens as you cook in it and you fry in it, some people think that it's just oil that's seeping into the pores of the metal, but that's not actually what it is. The seasoning is a film of polymerized oil, so it's oil that's essentially turned into a plastic through the action of the heat. And once it's polymerized, it's no longer affected by detergent. It's no longer affected by soap the way that regular oil is. So you can use soap in it as long as your cast iron pan is seasoned well. You can use soap in it, no problem. The only thing you want to make sure of is just don't let it sit there wet because it'll get some rust spots on it. So when cast iron pan, care for it is as simple as do it like any other pan. Like, use soap and water to clean it out if you want to, and then just dry it very carefully. I just dry it by setting it over a burner and letting the excess moisture evaporate off, and just rub a little oil into it after each use. And cast iron will last forever. And then a lot of people also go on and on about the proper way to season a cast iron pan. And there's articles on the internet, like there's a famous article on the internet about using flaxseed oil to season your cast iron pan. I think a lot of people have read that one. And to me, it's just like, it's crazy. Like, why do you go through this, like, several week-long process of seasoning your pan before you even use it, when all you have to do to season it is just use it? Like, that's all you have to do. Just fry some eggs in it. Yeah. Like, cooking it like for a couple weeks, you can be, and it's going to get better and better and better. Like, the first few times, you don't want to like try and make an omelet in a cast iron pan the first time you use it. But saute vegetables, sear some steaks, just like use it and it'll get better and it'll eventually season itself. You don't really have to worry about it. Like, cast iron pans are really, really much easier than people make them out to be, I think. So yes, a good cast iron pan, and don't care about it as much as people tell you to care.
That's pretty good. I have an oven question for you. Convection.
Mm-hmm.
When somebody said, oh yeah, yes. I understand that convection is blowing heat around, right?
It's just blowing air around.
Blowing air around. Mm-hmm. Does one always want that to happen? When would you, mm-hmm. would you and would you not use the convection setting on an oven?
So, no, one does not always want one's oven to be on convection. So convection, all it does is it circulates hot air around the oven. So it'll get, without a convection fan, air will transfer energy to the food, and then it forms like a sort of like envelope of like slightly lower energy air, like lower heat air around the food. So your food, and then eventually that slowly circulates away because of the natural convection currents created by the heat differential. So you do get like a flow of energy around your food, but convection just forces that heat flow around. You don't always want it though, first of all, not all recipes are designed for it. In fact, most recipes aren't designed for it. So for instance, I have a chocolate chip cookie recipe online.
I'm very interested.
A long chocolate chip cookie recipe. It's not in the book. It's online. You can look it up. It's one of my favorite recipes. But that one, I recently tried to make it at a friend's house, and I put it in their oven on convection and didn't realize that I had done that. And I came back after the allotted cooking time, and what I found is that, like, so first of all, they didn't spread very well because the heat comes to them way too rapidly, so the outside of the cookies I kind of set before they even had a chance to, like, melt and spread out. So they were these, like, kind of, like, misshapen blobs that were, like, black on the outside also, and raw in the middle. So, convection is going to heat up the exterior of your food much faster. So you want to use it for things like, if you're trying to, like, crisp. If you do the roast, the prime rib recipe in the book, for example, where you cook the prime rib very low and slow to begin with, take it out and then blast it in a hot oven just before serving. Convection will help it crisp up faster. Convection will help like turkey skin and chicken skin crisp up faster. Convection's great if like you're roasting a tray of Brussels sprouts and you want them to char. So like basically anytime you want the exterior of something to get like an unproportionately high amount of the energy in that oven, that's when you would use convection. But for baking, I typically would not recommend it unless you like your cookies black and blob shaped. Yeah. I guess
I think that's going to be kind of a tough sell. Okay, we have a question about eggplant.
Okay,
you have a really cool chart in your book about vegetables.
Do?
Yeah, you do. Actually, I have to say, as a person who enjoys data, the charts in this book are really truly enjoyable. And one of the things that you have is a table sort of indicating different vegetables and the appropriate ways to cook them from sautéing and braising, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And somebody is asking a question about eggplant, which I noticed in your matrix of what types of cooking was appropriate did not get very many.
What did I say? Yeah.
I think you said you could sauté it. You did not recommend... I think you recommended sautéing and...
And grilling, maybe?
Maybe grilling and roasting.
I don't recommend
you
boiling.
Boiling was not on the list. So an audience member is asking about salting eggplant, which is a common idea. Mm-hmm. And in cookbooks, you see this all the time. Mm-hmm. Salt the eggplant, set it over a colander, let the liquid... What should we be doing with our eggplant?
You can salt eggplant. People typically give two different reasons for salting eggplant. One of them is that it draws out bitter juices. Modern eggplants don't really taste bitter; like they don't really have many bitter juices. So that's not really a good reason. The other reason is that you want to kind of collapse the cell structure. Mm-hmm. So salting it will draw out liquid. You can then press on the eggplant; it'll collapse, and then it will absorb less oil. So if you're going to saute an eggplant or roast it or grill it, salting it first and pressing it is a reasonably good way to make sure that it's going to brown properly without absorbing a ton of oil. It's not 100% necessary. Sometimes what I'll do is instead of salting it and letting it sit, if I'm cooking just for myself or for a couple people, I'll actually microwave the eggplant I'll put it between a couple pieces of paper towel and a couple plates, microwave it. It'll draw out some moisture and then the plates will kind of flatten them down, and it's a much faster way of doing it than salting it. You can also accept the fact that it's going to absorb some oil at the beginning and then slowly expel it. And you'll find that a lot of recipes that call for eggplant, Middle Eastern and Mediterranean cuisine, like eggplant is often paired with a lot of olive oil, a lot of fat, because it tastes nice. And partly because you need it to cook the eggplant. I think it's just a good pairing anyway, like olive oil and eggplant. So I think in the book there's a recipe for pasta alla norma, which is a Sicilian dish. And in that one, all you do is cut up the eggplant and very slowly saute it in olive oil, very, very gently saute it. So it cooks through, it absorbs some of the oil, but it slowly cooks through and then it really nicely caramelizes and turns really nice and sweet on the outside. And as it cooks, some of that oil will come back. As it cooks down, some of that oil comes back out again, which you can then sort of emulsify into your tomato sauce. Salting is good, but it's not 100% necessary for all applications.
Cool. Another person says that they grind their meat now and they want recommendations on storage and meat choices.
Storage and meat choices. Okay, well, it depends what you're going to do with it. Grinding your meat, I think, is a great idea for almost any type of ground meat recipe. Grinding your own meat is a good idea. At the very least, buying whole cuts and getting the butcher to grind it for you in front of you. And showing you that he's not smashing it and compressing it into a styrofoam tray. The main reason you want to grind your meat, well, there's two reasons. One of them is texture. So particularly if you're making something like a hamburger where you want the meat to stay nice and loose and have nice pockets for juices and fat to collect in, you want it to stay really nice and loose and you don't want to pack it down too tightly. So one of them is texture because, when the meat is prepackaged in those styrofoam trays, it's already dense. And then the other one is being able to control flavor. Cows are pretty complex animals, and they have different muscles that have different flavors to them. And when you grind meat, that flavor comes through in the ground meat. So you can try this at home. Get yourself a bunch of different cuts meat from the from one steer and grind it and make yourself like a hamburger varietals. Maybe you can pair it with wine varietals too, but just make yourself some hamburger varietals and eat like a straight up brisket burger next to a straight up short rib burger, and you'll see that there's like a huge difference in flavor. A brisket has like a sort of higher, sort of more like almost a sour, like metallic flavor to it, whereas short rib is like really deep and rich. And so when I'm blending meats to make a hamburger, I think of it almost like I'm building a chord in music. And so you want like something really rich and deep, like short rib in there. You want something that's in the middle that's going to fill out that middle space. I'll use sirloin, or maybe just like sirloin's good, or flat meat, something like that. And then you want something that's going to hit a few of those sort of high acidic, minerally notes, and that's where brisket comes in. And if you are if you don't want to bother with all that because it's super fussy and you just want to get one cut of meat, then chuck is like the shoulder is the best sort of balance between all those things. As for storing it, that's an odd question. I never think about storing extra hamburgers. I don't know. I would vacuum seal it and freeze it. Anytime you freeze. Well, anything really, in particular with meat, what you want to do is minimize the formation of ice crystals, because that's what, like, if you've ever frozen a steak and then taken out and cooked it, you see that it weeps out a lot more liquid than a fresh steak does, and the reason is because as it's freezing, these jagged ice crystals form inside and they rupture the cells, and the more slowly something freezes, the bigger those ice crystals will form. So you want to, if you're going to freeze meat, particularly ground meat or like a soup or a stew or anything where you don't want to really drastically alter the texture, you want to get it as flat as possible. So when I'm freezing ground meat, I'll put it in a vacuum seal bag or in a Ziploc bag, press all the air out and lay it as flat as possible. So it's like a disc of meat, like this, with very, very thin, and then place it in the freezer there. It'll freeze really quickly, and it'll thaw very quickly as well, and it'll retain more moisture. That freezing thing, this is totally unrelated to food. Maybe it's not unrelated to food, but I read a few years ago that the main reason why we can't the technological barrier to cryogenically freezing humans right now is that we don't have the right surface area to volume ratio. So like our outsides freeze before we just freeze too slowly, and these ice crystals form. These ice crystals form and rupture our cells. But you can actually take and I don't recommend doing this, but you can take like a goldfish or like a really flat, thin fish, freeze it in liquid nitrogen and defrost it, and it's fine. And it's because it has I'm serious. And it's because it has high surface area to volume ratio, because it freezes very, very rapidly, so it doesn't have ice crystal formation.
I think the Commonwealth Club would like to take this opportunity to apologize to people for the ethical treatment of animals.
Take a goldfish, a cat, and a hamster.
Actually, at this point, I'd like to remind our radio audience that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. I'm Joanna Perlstein, Deputy Managing Editor at Wired, and your moderator for tonight's program. Our guest is Serious Eats' J. Kenji Lopez-Alt, author of the new cookbook, The Food Lab, Better Home Cooking Through Science. I mentioned at the beginning fresh herbs and dried herbs, mm-hmm. and an audience member would like to know, what can I do with dried herbs, and when do I have to use fresh?
Okay, that's a good question. Okay, so fresh herbs and dried herbs. So some people think that fresh herbs are always better than dried herbs, and that's not actually the case. A lot of it comes down to the specific type of herb you have. So herbs that grow in more dry, arid, and less humid areas, they tend to have aromatic compounds that are less volatile than herbs that grow in moister environments. So your drier herbs, like things like bay leaves and oregano and marjoram and thyme, and rosemary, because they have less volatile flavor compounds, they lose less of their aroma when they dry out. So things like oregano, dried oregano will have a lot more flavor to it than dried basil will, or dried parsley, or dried chives will. So for a dish like, for any time you're going to cook a dish for a long time, those types of arid, dry herbs tend to work actually pretty well. So like if you're making a tomato sauce, you don't need to use fresh oregano if you're going to be cooking it for a couple hours. Just dried oregano works totally fine. But on the other hand, if you're going to finish a dish, then that's when you do want to use fresh herbs like parsley, basil, whatever it is. If it's going to affect the texture, you want to use fresh herbs. I noticed in California in particular, a lot of people use fresh bay leaves as opposed to dried bay leaves, which is something that I actually don't recommend because Because typically the dried bay leaves we get are Turkish bay leaves, mm-hmm. Whereas the California bay leaves, it's a different species. And the California bay tends to be a lot more sort of this like eucalyptus menthol-y aroma to it, as opposed to the Turkish bay leaves. So I find like, at least when I'm making, you know, if I'm making like a bechamel with bay leaf in it, anytime I'm adding bay leaf to a food with the fresh California bay leaves, I find that it gets this kind of overwhelming eucalyptus flavor to mm-hmm. it, which maybe people in California love. I guess I should if they do, I should get used to it because I'm going to be here a while. But I recommend dried Turkish bay leaves for most cooking applications.
We were talking earlier, before we started this, about risotto, and you were talking about how you're rinsing your rice for risotto in
right.
cooking starch. And someone is asking about rinsing rice, which is another mm-hmm. kind of big question. So I'm wondering, do you rinse your rice? What do you do with it?
Well, it depends what I want to do with it. So if I'm talking like, all right, so if I'm talking about like Thai style glutinous, like super sticky rice, then you absolutely don't rinse it because you want that stickiness to be there. If I'm talking like a Chinese style short grain rice, something that I'm going to use, or medium grain rice, something that I'm going to be serving with like a saucy food, I also don't rinse it. If I'm talking like sushi rice, where I want it to be just mildly sticky, then I'll rinse it a little bit. If I'm talking like an American style rice, and I want it to be nice and fluffy, then I rinse it a lot. So basically all you're doing when you're rinsing it is you're rinsing surface starches off. And the more surface starches there are remaining in the pot, the stickier your rice is going to end up. So it really depends on, you know, what you want to do with the rice at the end. For risotto, I'll rinse my rice, but then add the starch back later. And the reason is because when you're making risotto, typically you'll take your rice, Arborio or Viola, no, whatever that is, Italian. One of those short grain extra starchy rices. When you're making a risotto, usually the first step is to toast the raw rice in butter or olive oil, it helps set up the exterior a little bit so that it gets more bite, but it also adds a little bit of flavor. The problem, though, is that the more you toast it, the weaker the thickening and the binding power of the starch becomes. So if you were to toast your rice until it gets like a really nice savory or like nutty aroma, and then you add all your liquid to it, it doesn't thicken up and turn creamy the way that risotto is supposed to. So what I actually do is I'll take my rice and I'll rinse it in the liquid that I'm going to cook it in later. So I'll rinse it in chicken stock or vegetable stock or whatever it is. Get most of the starches off there, and then I can toast it as deep as I want. And then when I add my liquids back to it, I'm adding the starch back with the liquids. So you keep the starch and the rice separate, toast it as much as you want, and then you still end up with a super creamy risotto at the end.
So some of us have become aware of your work on a fried chicken sandwich, and I understand that part of this recipe may be appearing, or something like it could be appearing, in a future book project. Can you talk about your next project?
Oh yeah, my next project. My next project is actually part of this project. So this book, it started out as a 380-page book that was supposed to come out in 2011 or something like that. That's what I was commissioned to write, and then I started writing, and it was just like, all right, I'm writing about grinding meat, and it seems like a waste to write about hamburgers, but not write about sausages, and it seems like a waste to write about sausages and not about meatloaf, and the meatballs are basically just small meatloaves, and so the whole thing like meatballed into a bigger and bigger project. And eventually I wrote 800 pages. I turned it in, and then my editor was like, oh, this is great. Can you write another 800 pages? And I was like, okay, yes, I can. And so I wrote another 800 pages. So we had this 1,600 pages of book that we were going to divide, and it was originally going to be a two-volume box set, and then like we realized it was maybe a little bit optimistic to ask like booksellers to carry a $100 two-volume box set by a first-time author. We decided to cut it down into this 1,000-page thing, which means that I now have 600 pages of book that I'm just sitting on. We cut it down, I think, in a relatively intelligent way. So the next project is going to be the material in that 600 pages plus some other stuff I'm doing, but it's all foods that the foods that I actually typically eat more often, which are all foods that you can eat with your hands. So sandwiches, burgers, pizza, tacos, things like that. Very similar in style, so exploring the science of these things, but a different set of foods. And then that's going to be followed up by a vegetarian book.
Great. Well, we've reached the point in our program where there's time for only one last question, and I'm going to ask you about desserts. One of my favorite things. Not one of your favorite things, so we can't look forward to a Serious Eats Food Lab exploration of all things dessert related? she says.
So
hopefully.
Desserts are one of those things where it's like, so every once in a while, like once a summer, maybe I get a craving for, I'm like, oh, today I want an ice cream cone. Or if like someone puts a cookie in front of me.
And then you hand make the cone and you make your own ice cream and everything.
If someone puts a cookie in front of me, it's like, oh, that cookie's pretty good. So desserts are one of those things where I eat it, but I very rarely get cravings for it. And I think it's similar when I'm working. It's like, I never get a strong desire to work on a dessert recipe, but usually if I like get myself into it, then I really enjoy it. So like two of my most popular and famous recipes are the pie crust I did for Cooks Illustrated, which has like the vodka in it.
Mm-hmm. That was you?
Yeah, that was
me. Oh, cool.
And then the chocolate chip cookies I did for Serious Eats. And both of them were projects that I was like, oh, like, do I really have to do this? I should probably do this. And then I got into it and I was like, oh my God, this is so awesome. So if I can, I think if I like can get to the sort of state of mental self-discipline where I really force myself to do it, then I'll enjoy it and I might do it, but it'll probably be a little ways down the road.
Great. Well, I think we've probably run out of time, so I'd just like to say our thanks to J. Kenji Lopez-Ault, Managing Culinary Director at Serious Eats and author of the new cookbook, The Food Lab, Better Home Cooking Through Science. We'd also like to thank our audiences here on the radio and online. I'm Joanna Perlstein, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.